Morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Let's see. Got 11:30. Let's look at the list of. Okay, I've got 11:30. So why don't we get started? Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the meeting to order. First item of business is our roll call. When I call your name, if you could please indicate you being on the call. Starting with myself, Peter Lisi, obviously I'm present. Marty Budd.
Here.
Thank you. Andrew Foster. I believe Andrew's going to join us in a few minutes. Andrew, are you on now? I don't believe so. Daryl Hill. Daryl? No. Michael Azadi? Michael? Our batting average isn't so good so far. How about Carrie Kelly?
Here.
Thank you, Carrie. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Julie Savino?
Present.
Thank you. And Laura Baker. Let's try a few of those again. Daryl Hill, are you on yet? No Daryl. Julie Savino?
Oh, here, I said present.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay.
Yeah, that's okay, Peter.
So we're waiting on Andrew and Daryl. Michael Azadi?
Present.
Okay. All right, I believe we have a quorum, so we can get started. Thank you all. First item of business are the minutes from our September meeting. I'm hoping folks took some time to review them. Is there a motion to accept the minutes as presented?
Well, I have two amendments, and then I'll make a motion with those changes. On page 10 of the book, both cases, it says Mr. Budd, but it should be Mr. Lisi requested a motion, and Mr. Budd moved.
That's right. Yep.
And then on page 13, it's the same thing in the middle of the page. Mr. Lisi requested a motion, and Mr. Budd moved. Okay. With those two changes, I'll move adoption of the minutes.
All right. With those two amendments, two corrections, would someone like, Marty has moved it. Is there a second?
I'll second. It's Julie.
Thank you, Julie. Any other questions or comments, clarifications, or edits to those minutes? Marty, I'm happy to be confused with you from time to time, but I appreciate those clarifications. Let's make the minutes correct.
And the feeling is mutual.
Thank you. All right. Hearing no other clarifications or edits or corrections, all those in favor of accepting the minutes with the amendments or with the corrections pointed out by Marty, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed?
I'm going to abstain since I wasn't here at that meeting. Thank you.
Right. I would expect. Yeah. And any other abstentions? All right. The motion passes. Thank you very much. Okay, our next item of business is our annual ethics training. I believe I'll be turning it over to Peter Lewandowski. Peter, the floor will be yours.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Again, my name is Peter Lewandowski. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of State Ethics. I will provide you with a brief overview of the ethics code for public officials. This will take probably 15 or so minutes, so it's an abbreviated version of what we normally do. If you just bear with me for a second, I'll share my screen with you. Hopefully everyone can see this PowerPoint, and we'll start along. So again, this is a brief overview of the basic provisions of the Code of Ethics, with a particular focus on the conflicts of interest. It is tailored specifically, this presentation is tailored specifically for members of state boards, quasi-public boards. We'll cover conflicts of interest, but also some aspects regarding contracting with the state and moonlighting. If you forget everything that I say today, I hope you can remember this particular slide. Always get advice. This cannot be stressed enough. The importance of seeking ethics advice if you have questions about something. There are no stupid questions in ethics. They range from fairly straightforward to quite complex that will require some research and input from various from our staff attorneys collectively and so on. So again, I encourage you to always seek advice. Now, there are a couple avenues on how to obtain advice. The most common one is to obtain an informal ethics advice, and this can be done informally over the phone if you prefer to maintain anonymity. Obviously, a phone call is the preferred route. If you communicate with us in writing, please be mindful that written opinions, written communications are subject to freedom of information laws. So that's why we offer offer state employees and public officials the option of first calling us and then following up in writing if they want, if you want, for example, a written documentation of the opinion. You also have your ethics liaison. Denise Aguilar as your ethics liaison for purposes of your quasi-public agency. The agency may have an internal ethics policy that can be more restrictive than the code of ethics, or it may address specific issues that are pertinent to your operations. Therefore, if you have questions concerning the internal ethics policy, we would urge you to first speak to your agency ethics liaison. Also on our website, there are plenty of there's plenty of information, plain language guides to that can provide you with straightforward answers to any basic questions. Also, just one important note: there's a firewall between our compliance division, legal division, and our enforcement division. Therefore, the way it is set up here. And this was set up by the legislature is to encourage public officials to ask questions, to seek advice without concerns that the communications when requesting advice will not be used for enforcement purposes. In situations, if you witness something or something gives you certain misgivings or raises, you may have discomfort about a situation that that you are experiencing relative to the ethics code. If you have any questions, you can also have that anonymous conversation with our legal division to make sure to determine if conduct that you witnessed is questionable under the ethics code. Also, if there are internal matters relative to the ethics policy, internal ethics policy, it is recommended that you speak with your ethics liaison or agency counsel or human resources, individuals within human resources department. Also, you always have an opportunity, and this applies to generally actually to members of the public and all public officials and state employees. Folks can provide an anonymous tip with our office, directly with our enforcement division. One important note, the agency heads, their deputies, persons in charge of state agency procurement, contracting, or human resources, and this applies to all quasi-publics, if those individuals have reasonable cause to believe that an ethics code has been violated, they have a legal obligation to report to such alleged violations to our office. And those mandatory reports are essentially treated in the same fashion as an anonymous tip. So they're not considered complaints, but simply reports for use and investigation by our enforcement division. One note about formal complaints, anyone can file a formal complaint with our office. What I want to stress here, please know that the whole process of filing a complaint pretty much up until probable cause is established by a superior court judge remains confidential. And the reason why confidentiality is stressed in ethics enforcement proceedings up until probable cause is established is because, as you can appreciate, ethics allegations can have adverse impact on someone's professional or personal reputation. Therefore, confidentiality is taken seriously when we are handling complaints. And again, everything remains confidential until an independent judicial authority determines that there is enough evidence, probable cause to proceed further. So what's the point as we go through some of the major provisions? What is the point behind all these provisions? Essentially, any governmental ethics code, whether we're talking about our state of Connecticut code or federal code or a municipal code of ethics, the main point of it is to prevent public officials and state employees, in our case, to misuse their official authority or position for personal financial gain, of their immediate family members or any associated businesses. So that's the common thread that links all these provisions. So let's jump to our, again, this will be very brief on the subject of gifts. Many of you probably have already heard this before, but just a quick refresher. When we deal with gifts, generally, gifts, well, it depends on who's the donor. There are three types of donors. The folks that you should be most concerned about are the so-called restricted donors, because there is a ban on accepting gifts from restricted donors unless those gifts meet certain applicable exceptions. And who are the restricted donors? Registered lobbyists in the state of Connecticut. And to find out who's a registered lobbyist, you can go to our website. We have a portal for lobbyist registrations. If anyone has registered 5 minutes ago, their name will be listed on our portal. And there's about 1,000 plus client lobbyists and about 500 or so communicator lobbyists, individuals who communicate on behalf of their clients. So if you want to find out if someone is a registered lobbyist, just check on our website. Also, individuals who are either regulated or are doing or have some form of official interaction with your agency, with your board, those folks would also be considered restricted donors. And finally, pre-qualified vendors who are contracted with the state to provide basic services, let's say IT services, equipment, and various services to state and quasi-public agencies. Those entities or individuals are considered restricted donors as well. We also have the less important group would be non-restricted folks who are giving you something by virtue of your state position. The financial thresholds are slightly different for those folks. They could provide, in addition to all the applicable gift exceptions, $100 per year. And finally, everyone else, there's no restriction for those individuals. So I've mentioned at the outset, the folks that you should be most concerned about are the so-called restricted donors.
Excuse me, Peter.
Sure.
This is Peter Lisi of the board. I have a question on that, the restricted donors, specifically the lobbyists. Mm-hmm. I was always under the assumption that there was an obligation or responsibility by an individual to disclose that they're a lobbyist. Did I have that wrong? Is the obligation not on them to disclose it?
You are correct. If an individual is a registered lobbyist, and they are interacting with a state or quasi-public agency, they have to wear a badge that identifies them as a registered lobbyist when they interact officially with you in your official capacity. That's correct. There are various rules that also govern what lobbyists can or cannot do, but that at a minimum, they have to identify themselves as a registered lobbyist.
Thank you.
Sure. In terms of restricted donors, as I said, there is the general ban on accepting gifts, and a gift is anything of value directly or personally received unless consideration of equal value is given in return. However, the code has 19 gift exceptions, and I will not go through them. You probably heard about some of them, or the frequently used gift exceptions. We're talking about luncheons. When someone invites you to a lunch, they can provide a lunch. They have to be in attendance up to $50 per year per source. If the lunch goes over, you have to pay down the difference. That's over $50.
I think these are
token items are permissible.
Viable ones I thought were the most viable were these three.
And also, you know, governmental discounts that are available to all state employees or all public officials, regardless for what agency they work for. Those are just the very few. One particular provision under gifts that I want to briefly focus on is the so-called necessary expenses and gifts to the state when attending a conference on behalf or in your official capacity as a representative of CHESLA, in your case. So you are attending in your official capacity, you represent your agency or the board at a conference, it could be regional, national, what have you. It all depends on what type of activity you engage in. Are you an active participant or a passive participant? If you're an active participant, you're a speaker, panelist, moderator of a panel, you may receive necessary expenses. And technically, when you're an active participant, necessary expenses are not considered a gift because the expenses are actually given to you in consideration of your provision of your expertise to those who attend the conference. You're the speaker. So in lieu of fees or honoraria, that you may receive necessary expenses for your active participation. Now, on the other hand, you may be a passive participant. In other words, you are attending a conference to learn new things, to acquire new skills, to acquire expertise in a given field. And you are just simply there to as a student or there to learn and listen. In that case, you may also attend a conference and accept basic expenses, but that would fall under the gifts to the state rule, provided attending that conference is relevant to your state duties. And what can you accept? Generally, basic travel, lodging, meals, and related conference expenses that are not lavish. Now, you may wonder, what's not lavish? Essentially, the standard is, what would the state pay to send you to a conference? So that's the standard for lavishness. What would the state pay to send you to a conference? Now, we know for sure that the state will not pay first class travel. The state will not put you at some exclusive resort or send you to dine at some fancy restaurants. Just the basic conference expenses, and we understand that some of the costs may vary from city to city because certain cities are more expensive than other when you attend a conference. But nonetheless, generally, that's the rule. What would the state pay to send you to a conference? Now, the state will not pay for entertainment, so that's not permissible. You are on your own. Finally, there is a disclosure requirement. If you receive lodging and or out-of-state travel costs from a private entity, you are obligated to file a brief report with our office. It's available online. It's a very simple one-page report. It doesn't take long to fill out. And you have a 30-day window to submit that report after attending a conference. Also, if the conference is funded by federal government or another state government, another state entity, let's say you have a state university, pick your state university, UMass or University of Michigan, you attend a conference. If they're the host, you have no obligation to file this report if another state entity pays for your attendance. All right, so just a quick recap about if you accidentally accept a prohibited gift, you can either immediately refuse or return the gift, or you have a 30-day window to pay the donor fair market value. You also have the 30-day window to return the gift. So that 30-day window applies to both paying the fair market value or returning the gift if it doesn't meet any of the gift exceptions. Use of state position, a major area. It's a very broad provision that kind of links many of these provisions, whether it's gifts or conflicts. You may not use your state position for your own financial gain or that of your immediate family members or any associated businesses. Associated business is a defined term. It means any business you own or in which you or your spouse is an officer or let's say a shareholder of more than 5% of the stock of the business. So in this, under this provision, you may not take official action for the benefit of that outside business. Now, one area that I'll spend a little bit more time here is conflicts of interest. This is frequently faced by board members of various boards. You're about to take official action, and you may wonder, well, do I have a conflict? Now, what's a conflict? Essentially, you have to ask yourself, do you think that you or your spouse or any associated business will derive financial benefit if you take certain official action? And is the benefit distinct from any other similarly situated individual? That's a very important question to answer. Are you being treated differently than others in a similarly situated situation? And we're talking others means large groups, members of the same profession, or industry, and so on. So if the answer to these questions is yes, then you have to determine, are you dealing with a direct or potential conflict, or if you have an appearance of a conflict. Potential conflicts are easy to spot. Essentially, when you're required to take official action that would affect financial interest of you, your spouse, direct conflicts. So direct conflicts are easy to spot. You have a reason to believe or expect that either you, your spouse, dependent child, or an associated business will obtain direct monetary gain or suffer direct monetary loss by reason of your official activity in a way that is distinctly different from others in a similarly situated group or occupation. What do you do? And again, direct conflicts are immediate. There are no intervening conditions. So you award a contract, you know that if the contract is awarded to a private entity, that private entity will have immediate financial benefit. So in that case, you have a direct conflict, and recusals are required in the face of direct conflicts. What about potential conflicts? They're more nuanced. You essentially are taking official action that would affect the financial interests of either you, and if you notice, the group is slightly larger here, your spouse, your parents, your siblings, spouses of your children, associated businesses. Now, there's no potential conflict if the resultant gain or loss is equal to a substantial segment of the public. In other words, you're not treated in any distinct manner. Or the action is de minimis in nature, less than $100 in value. In terms of potential conflicts, now what's the test? You have to have a reasonable expectation that there will be some financial impact based on your action. There's no requirement that the impact be direct. However, you have to have reasonable expectation. In other words, there is a likelihood that you will derive financial benefit as opposed to being merely conceivable. Now, as a member of a deliberative body, as a member of a quasi-public board, when faced with potential conflicts, you have an option of either abstaining or preparing a written statement on the record, and it has to be recorded in the minutes of your agent of your board, that you have a conflict, and despite this conflict, you may still act in the public's benefit, and that statement has to, as I said, has to be recorded and also forwarded. A copy of it has to be forwarded to the Office of State Ethics. So, in potential conflicts, you have that option of either abstention or preparation of that written statement and then voting on the record and explaining why, despite the conflict, you may still vote objectively and to the benefit of the greater public. Appearances of a conflict. There's the Office of State Ethics has no jurisdiction with respect to appearances. That's really left to your judgment and discretion. It's an optics test, really. However, we do note that if you come to the Office of State Ethics and you present to us a fact pattern where we determine that there's no direct or potential conflict, but nonetheless, there's a strong appearance issue, we will bring that to your attention. And it's still left to your judgment and discretion whether you wish to proceed. One thing to note is maybe you should have an internal conversation with a director of executive director of your agency, because maybe an appearance of a conflict, a strong appearance of a conflict may have adverse impact on the agency. But ultimately, again, you have no legal obligation. It's just left to your judgment whether you wish to proceed in the face of an appearance of a conflict. Few words very briefly about outside employment, generally permitted for public officials and state employees. Clearly, most public officials who serve voluntarily on the board do engage in outside employment. However, that outside employment must not impair your independence of judgment. You may not disclose any confidential information that you've learned in your state service for the benefit of your outside employment endeavors. And you may not use your state position, meaning your equipment, authority, staff, time to advance outside employment endeavors. One note about contracting with the state. If your agency board exercises control over certain contracts subject matter, board members may not contract with the quasi-public agency unless the contract process is open and public. So if there's a contract over which you exercise certain control, you as a board member may not pursue the contract unless that process is open and public advertised to the public. Generally, you have to follow the same process that, let's say, someone out there would be seeking a contract with your agency. One note here, executive head of a quasi-public agency may not contract with the agency to obtain a contract. Finally, last few words. This is the last area. Revolving door provisions. There are four revolving door provisions that you should be mindful upon leaving state service. Two lifetime bans. Common sense. You cannot disclose confidential information you've learned in state service. Also, you may not. There's a prohibition on site switching. You may not represent anyone in particular matters in which you were involved substantially as an official or employee. What that means is, let's say you awarded a contract to someone, to some entity, and you end up being employed by that entity, you cannot then represent that entity on that specific contract. So it's a particular matter. It's very narrow in its application. It's someone else has to, in other words, represent that entity, not you, because you've handled that contract while you were serving on the board. And two one-year restrictions. You may not represent anyone for compensation before CESLA for 1 year. A key thing to remember is compensation. So it has to be truly pro bono representation, not a delayed compensation for you to represent someone within that first year of post state service. And if you've been involved in awarding, negotiating contracts valued at $50,000 or more, you may not pursue employment with the recipient of such contract for 1 year if the contract was assigned within your final year of state service. And that's a dual ban. It prohibits not only you from pursuing employment, but also the employer from hiring you. That said, this is essentially, in a nutshell, a brief presentation. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have. Let me just minimize my PowerPoint here. Here we go. If you have any questions, if you don't, that's fine. As I said, the third slide is probably the most important one. If you have any questions or you wish to obtain advice, please contact our office or reach out to Denise Aguilera so she can facilitate communications with our office on your behalf.
Peter, it's Daryl Hill. Good to see you again.
Hi, Daryl.
One question. Apologize for being a few minutes late, but when I joined, you were talking about confidentiality. And not until a judge determines, maybe was it probable cause or something?
Correct.
My question is about if the judge determined that there was not probable cause, does all of the information related to the claim then become public and FOIable?
Well, the actual, the matter stays confidential, and the fact that the complaint's been filed with our office would not be released. So for example, the case, if the judge determines there's no probable cause, that file is essentially sealed, it stays confidential. Now, if parties, if there is some information that parties can obtain through other channels, that's obviously, and it relates to some of it, it would not be released by our office.
And the information that, say, the state agency or quasi-state agency provided to your office, does that fall under the cloak of confidentiality? Or if the agency or quasi was asked for it, do we have to produce it? I know it's an FOI question, but
it could be released independently. In other words, for freedom of information purposes, the communications that you've had with our office, that's a good question. That's a freedom of information question. If you have a mandatory report filed with our office and there is some information in it, potentially could be FOIable, but the mere fact that that information was used in a complaint that was then deemed by a judge to have insufficient evidence to proceed to a full-blown hearing, not enough evidence, then that would stay confidential.
Thank you, Peter.
Yep.
I had two questions, but they were for Jeanette. One, do we have a policy that board members can't buy Chesla bonds? Is that right? I see Denise saying yes.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Denise, do you want to address that?
Are there any other restrictions other than that, that, you know, don't go to the Office of Ethics, but go to our own rules?
So Marty, with regard to board members, that's correct. There is a restriction on owning Tesla bonds. And then with regard to staff is not permitted to accept any gifts at all from vendors.
And my other question is, this session that we've just had with Peter, is this for partially for the staff as well, or does the staff have a separate ethics training at other times?
Yes, the staff will have its own ethics training in December.
Thank you.
Denise, this is Peter. Just to clarify your answer to Marty with regard to board members owning Chesla bonds, I understand that it's direct ownership, correct?
Correct.
If a bond is held like within a mutual fund or something, you don't need to direct your advisor to avoid a mutual fund which may hold that bond, correct?
That's correct.
It's just the direct ownership?
Yes, direct.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. All right. Next item of business is on the agenda is our inducement resolution. But before we get to that, I just want to step back a minute. I was remiss in not introducing our newest board member, Carrie Kelly, representing the Connecticut State College and Universities, is replacing Ben Barnes on our board. So Carrie, I'm not sure if you are still on the call, but I want to apologize for not introducing you sooner and welcoming you to the board.
So, thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, thank you.
What is your position, Carrie, with the organization that oversees the colleges and universities.
Yeah, happy to tell you all a little bit about myself. I'm the Vice President of Finance and Administration, the Chief Financial Officer for the Connecticut State Community College. As you know, our 12 institutions are merging into a singly accredited college effective next July. So that's very exciting. I've been here about 3 years now. I was formerly with the Office of Policy and Management for 9 years, working in higher ed issues, working with fellow board member Mike Izzotti quite closely. And then prior to that, I was with the General Assembly's nonpartisan fiscal office.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie. And welcome. Okay, Jeanette, would you like to walk us through the inducement resolution?
Yes, the inducement resolution is on page 15 in your board package. And it is to, if you recall, when we did the bond refinancing this past spring, there was an equity release of $5 million with the stated use of those dollars to make refinance loans. And then at, I believe it was the last board meeting, the board approved the use of $2 million of those dollars to go towards in-school loans, given the volume of in-school loan activity that we're seeing. And so this inducement resolution will simply give Chesla more flexibility by allowing us in our next bond offering, to the extent we use any of that $2 million to fund in-school loans, we would be able to bond in the spring to reimburse ourselves that amount from bond proceeds. So it would only be for the amount that's actually used to make an in-school loan. If we did that in the spring when we bond, we can add that into the bond issue and reimburse ourselves. So in effect, we would be replenishing the dollars such that we would then still end up with back to the $5 million equity release that we had. So that is the purpose of the inducement resolution, and we are seeking a board vote on it, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
I wondered whether our lawyers can tell us whether the fact that we previously voted to do this, put $2 million in, this is called an inducement resolution, but we already were induced and did it. Whether this meets the requirements of the code, if you have an inducement resolution after you resolve to do it.
Hi, this is Sandy Dawson at Pullman and Comley. Yes, you can adopt the inducement resolution anytime you'd like. This merely allows you now to reimburse yourselves with bonds for any loans that are originated 60 days prior to today or any time after. So the mere fact that you've already fine.
Thank you.
And so inducement is just kind of a word that's often used, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's induced anything. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is Tim Webb with Hilltop Securities. Yeah. I just wanted to point out one thing with this. It's not just the principal amount of the loan that would potentially be reimbursed, but also the cost to originate that loan, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Thank you, Tim. Good clarification.
Does that require an amendment to this language? I can't remember what it says.
I don't believe so. I believe, Mr. Budd, that it's in the whereas class refers to the expenditure.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Well, this does require board approval. I would be happy to entertain a motion to accept the resolution as presented, if someone would like to move it.
So move Daryl Hill.
Oh, Daryl, okay. Good. I'll second Daryl's motion.
Thank you. We've got a motion. We've got a second. There has been some discussion, but are there any further questions or comments? Anyone need any clarification on this resolution and what it will accomplish? Anyone? Well, hearing none, the motion has been made and seconded to accept the resolution as presented. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you very much. Motion carries. The resolution passes. Thank you. Next item of business is a discussion on the Alliance District Program Manual and some modifications. Josh, are you going to walk us through those?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. So I'll start on page 16 of the board package. So I first wanted to review the Alliance District Program. As a reminder, this program was created with CHESLA and the Connecticut State Department of Education to help address the significant need across the state to recruit and retain educators in Alliance Districts. The teachers that refinance their loans into an Alliance District teacher refinance loan will receive a 3% interest rate subsidy on that loan as long as the teacher continues to teach in a Connecticut Alliance District. And as another reminder, the funding for this program, CHESL received funding from the state to fund these loans. Regarding the application summary for the ADTLS program, the first application was submitted on May 20th. However, consistent application volume did not start until July 12th. Volume through September is as follows. We received about 60 applications with 14 applications approved and dispersed, 19 applications denied, and the remainder 24 applications pending the underwriting process. Under the current guidelines for the program, applications currently may not have a DTI exceeding 50% as one of the criteria to qualify for the loan. Of the 19 applications denied, 68% or 13 of those denials were due to not meeting the debt to income ratio requirement. As you can see here on the memo, there's a vast range for the DTIs ranging from 60% to over 100%. So some higher DTIs there. So based on this information and as stated above, we do believe the purpose of this program is to incentivize the teacher recruitment and retention in the Alliance Districts. And we believe, however, that the high level of denials for failure to meet the DTI indicates that this requirement has been a barrier to these teachers accessing the program. We believe since these teachers already have this student loan debt and refinancing into this subsidized Alliance District teacher loan, which would result in more manageable payments, that this is only beneficial to increase the access for the teachers to receive the lower loans, or lower interest rate loans, and the resulting lower monthly payments. So as a result, we are proposing to remove the DTI requirement for the program and replace it with two credit knockout criteria in addition to the FICO score requirements that we already have in place. The two knockout criteria that we would add would be no record of any education loan default and no accounts rated 90 days late or more in the past 12 months. We believe these criteria will demonstrate the teacher's ability to make payments on their existing student loan debt and therefore indicate their ability to pay the debt at a lower interest rate and monthly payment. So I'll stop there before I turn it over to Denise. But are there any questions from the board regarding anything in the memo here? One thing I did want to mention is there is application and disbursement data regarding the program. For your information, And this can be found on pages 65 through 71 of the board package. So again, I'll stop there. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Josh? Josh, this is Peter. I have one. Just in those knockout criteria, where you say no accounts rated 90 days late in the past 12 months, no accounts, does that refer to any like credit account or credit card account out there or just a student loan account?
That would be referring to any account on the credit report. So any trade line. Okay. Any trade line, right.
Okay, thank you.
This is Daryl. That's similar to the question I was going to ask about the the 90 days late in the past 12 months. Was there discussion conversation about it possibly being 60 days as opposed to 90? I ask because, you know, probably not everyone, but, you know, folks from time to time will miss a payment and be 30 days late, they miss two payments and be 2 months behind. I think would be as revealing, if not more revealing, than getting 3 months behind the 90 days.
Right. So it's a good question, Daryl. There's various knockout criteria options with the credit bureau. Jeanette, Denise, and I met, and I think we all determined that we wanted to go with the 90 days, but there are options to go with a criteria that's, you know, no accounts rated 30 days within the last 12 months or no accounts 60 days. There is some flexibility there.
And just to sort of elaborate on the program, as it was developed, was really developed to serve, you know, like a public purpose, and that public purpose being to incentivize recruitment and retention of teachers to alliance districts. And there was also the hope that it would, that recruitment and retention would also lead to greater diversity of the teacher workforce in those districts. So with that as the public purpose of the program, that's part of why we were saying, well, we're not going to go by our standard underwriting guidelines. And the feeling is that because these are refinance loans and it's giving the teachers the opportunity, you know, if they've demonstrated, you know, payment on something that's got a 10% rate and now their rate will go down to 2%, that on that basis, we could say, yes, you know, we'll help you by giving you a 2% loan. But so we felt that 90 days was in the spirit of that, you know, achieving the public policy goal. But, you know, could it be tightened? Sure, it could be tightened.
Will the data, your future data, these alliance loans will be kept separate from the refi loan. So you'll give us data on how much is put out, what the abandonment rate is. Are you taking, it's going to be serviced by the same services our refi loans?
Hi, Marty, that is correct. So Campus Door is the loan originator. University Accounting Service, also known as UAS, is the servicer. And as I briefly mentioned previously, the reports you see on pages 65 through 71, specifically regarding this ADTLS program, you will receive in quarterly board packages moving forward.
Right, but the 65 to 91, that's just the regular refi loans, right?
No, pages 65 through 71 in the package should just be specific to this program.
Have we made alliance loans already?
So through September, we had approved and dispersed 14 loans.
I guess that's what confused me about who makes the submitted applications. The applications appear to come from the schools. Is that right? On page 65 on the right-hand side.
Yeah, I think what we're just trying to show you there is the volume coming in from the teachers and in what districts that they're in.
I see. So even though it says Bristol Board of Education, that was one application from one teacher there.
Correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Josh, I had a question. Thanks for such a thorough presentation. I understand how 13 of the 19 applicants were denied, but I'm curious, what happened to the other six? Why were they denied?
There were a couple due to FICO, a couple due to teachers trying to refinance federal loans, which we're not refinancing with this program. So those would be the two main other reasons.
Great, thank you.
Any other questions? Questions for Josh? All right, I believe this requires board approval.
Well, I think Peter, before we move on, if I can turn it over to Denise, I believe it's pages 18 through 37. Denise will discuss the changes with the program manual and the MOA with the State Department of Education.
So we're going to do it in one vote then, both.
We'll have two votes, Peter, one for the MOA and then one for the program manual. It's two different resolutions.
Right. That's why I thought we would do one now. But if we want to, why don't you go ahead and do the MOA proposed modification?
Okay. So, Kara, if you could put page 26 up from the screen, please. Thanks. So in addition to the changes to the credit criteria that Josh discussed, we're also proposing to amend the definition of teacher for purposes of eligibility for the program in the memorandum of agreement with the state of Connecticut and the program manual. The current definition of teacher is an individual with current Connecticut educator certification. So individuals other than classroom teachers, such as a principal or a business administrator, could have educator certification. So we're proposing to clarify the definition by adding the requirement that the individual must provide direct classroom type teaching or classroom type teaching in a non-classroom setting for more than 50% of their day in order to be eligible for the loan under the program. This requirement is similar to the requirement under the federal loan program for teacher loan forgiveness. The reason for the revision is to clarify the definition to reflect the intent of the program, which is to recruit and retain teachers rather than administrative staff in alliance districts. And we've discussed both the change in the credit criteria as well as the revised definition with the State Department of Education, and they're in agreement with both revisions. So we're seeking approval of the First Amendment to the Memorandum of Agreement with the state that would include the revised credit criteria and the definition of teacher. And there's a resolution in your board package for that purpose. It's on page 34. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
And Denise, it's Daryl. Just thinking through that. So I'm a teacher and I've been a teacher for years and I'm good at what I do. And so much so that the school district wants me to become an administrator, whatever kind of administrator. I would violate the criteria of the program and by leaving a teacher to be an administrator. So correct. It's a disincentive for teachers to become administrators.
That would be what occurs, but the legislation is called the Teacher Alliance Subsidy Program. The intent was always specifically to recruit and retain teachers in the schools and not administrators.
And just to clarify, if someone ceases to be a teacher in an alliance district, you know, either the scenario you're presenting or they leave and take another job, what happens to their alliance district loan is that the 3% subsidy goes away and it reverts back to CHESLA's refi loan rates. But, you know, in most instances, you know, that's still a very favorable loan rate relative to what their prior loans were. So there's still, you know, savings that they're technically achieving. You know, the loan isn't, you know, is not called and immediately due or anything of that sort. It just reverts back to this other interest rate and they would continue to make payments.
Thank you.
But it keeps within our statistics as an alliance loan after the is no longer an alliance loan, or you take it out of our data?
I think at that point, Josh, would we move it over to a refi, regular refi?
I would think so.
I don't think we've discussed that. I mean, technically, it would still be an alliance loan, because if they ever went back to teaching in an alliance district, then they would receive the subsidy again.
True.
Right.
So does so that mean
probably that footnote in it in some sort of way, Marty?
Right. I was going to suggest that on the data, you know, have a footnote for those that are no longer at the lower rate. Also, on the question with the memorandum with the State Department of Education, did the board ever see the original MOA?
Yes, Marty. It was included in the board package back when the program was approved.
Thank you.
Andrew, did you have a comment?
Oh, I was just going to say, based on what Daryl just described, so would there be a proration if the person was certainly eligible for 3 years or so, and then, I don't know, their fourth year, they got a promotion, and would they just automatically revert to refinance, or would they benefit at all during the time they were a teacher?
The there would be no recoupment of the 3% interest rate subsidy, so they would have had that subsidy while they were a teacher.
Okay.
If they're no longer a teacher, then that subsidy would just be taken away.
Right, but there are set time frames, and Josh, I don't know if you want to speak to the time frames under which you're verifying employment status.
Yeah, I believe I'm verifying employment status 3 or 4 times a year. I did my first verification with the districts in October, and we'll continue to do that throughout the year.
And how does this work? Where does the 3% come from? Do we get money from the state to reduce, or we just first of all, where does the money come to make the alliance loan?
So, Marty, we received, I believe it was $7 million from the state directly.
And and that's in a kind of separate account. We keep that separately because it's only for the Alliance Teacher Program?
That's correct. And then we're funding these loans directly out of that $7 million.
Oh, out of the $7 million.
Correct.
I see. So we have a limit on the amount of loans we can make.
Right.
Correct. And I think that's part of the reason we set the Alliance refi maximum at $25,000 in order to ensure we can impact at least 240 teachers.
And does that show up on our financials? Where does the $7 million show up?
Carly, do you want to touch on
that? Carly, are you on?
Yes, I'm here. It's going to be on page 49 of the board packet, actually 47 through 49, when I discuss our other programs. It's been added to the scholarship and the refi CT pages. So now there's 3 other programs to discuss.
I see, other programs. Scholarship, refi, ADTLS program?
Correct.
Alliance District Teachers. Okay, ADL. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Kara, could we have the resolution back up on the screen?
It's up page 34, Kara.
Okay. Any further questions either for Josh or Denise? Any further discussion or questions regarding the resolution? All right, would someone like to make a motion to approve or adopt, I'm sorry, adopt the resolution as presented?
I'll move that motion.
Thank you, Marty. Is there a second?
I'll second,
Andrew. Thank you, Andrew. So it's been made, the motion's been made and seconded to adopt the resolution as presented. We've had some discussion. Are there any further comments or questions? Any? Hearing none, we'll call for a vote. All those in favor of adopting the resolution as presented for the Alliance Teacher Refi Program Loan Program and the amendments to the MOA, please say aye.
Aye.
Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you very much. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you all. Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Denise.
Peter, there is another resolution for the program manual on page 18.
I'll move that as well.
And those amendments to the program manual will conform to the amendments made in the memorandum of agreement.
Right. So Marty has moved it. Is there a second?
Second.
I'll be happy to. All right, Andrew seconded it. Are there any questions or comments or discussion with regard to this resolution? Any questions or comments? Further discussion? Hearing none, motion's been made and seconded to adopt the resolution for the Alliance Teacher Refi Loan Program and the amendments to the program manual. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Is there anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Hearing none, the motion carries unanimously. Thank you all very much. Okay. Next item of business is a review of our financials. Carly?
Thank you. I'm going to start on page 41 of the board packet, and that'll be the agency's income statement for the 3 months ending September 30th, 2022, revenues over expenses before non-operating income and expenses were $12,878, and revenues over expenses after non-operating income and expenses were $18,938. Total year-to-date revenues were $901 under budget, and total year-to-date expenses were $6,176 under budget. Any questions regarding the agency? If not, Kara, if you wanted to move on to page 46 in the packet, and we'll take a look at the bond fund, which now just will show the 2019 resolution. The total change in net position for the 2019 resolution before transfers is a decrease of $179,121. And change in net position after transfers is a decrease of $175,499. And this is due primarily to an increase to the loan origination and servicing fees. I also do want to mention that besides the principal pay downs that occurred today, since it is November 15th, we are also redeeming an additional $4,440,000 from excess revenues for the 2019A, 2019B, and the 2020B bond series. Questions for the 2019 resolution? All right, page 50, please, Kara. And we'll take a look at the other program. Oh, I'm sorry, Page 49, I apologize. Thank you. For the scholarship fund, the total change in that position for this quarter was an increase of $594. Total change in that position for the non-bond refi program was an increase of $7,536. And the total change in that position for the Alliance District Teacher Loan Subsidy Program was a decrease of $9,572. And that's due primarily to the allowance for loan loss expense that we have.
But the administrative collection and other fees for the Alliance District program of $9,000. What? We just started the program. Tell me about the $9,000.
So I think, Chloe, that would be like our campus door and UAS fees?
Correct.
Right. So that's for the application process, Marty, and then for the 14 loans that dispersed, there's servicing fees as well.
Good. Thank you.
And yeah, this is Daryl. Just below that, the allowance for loan loss, the 22606, is that it's an expense. Are we moving that to restricted amounts for loans that have been approved, or is there, we haven't had any loan losses? It's an allowance. So it's moving it to a restricted account in case there are future loan losses?
Well, I believe, Carly, you're just showing it as a deduction from the amount available. How are you showing it on the balance sheet?
On the balance sheet, it is on, so that would be on page 47.
So 25?
Under the NASA assets below is a negative. Page 47.
Yep. It's an interesting accrual accounting question. Before you make the loans, even though you have the 7 million, 6 million and change, I guess you take out the loan loss reserve and say, hey, we're not going to have all the 7, 6.8 million of loans because we'll have 200. We'll have certainly $22,000 of loan loss.
Well, I think to clarify off of that, we're only taking out the loan loss based on what's dispersed.
Oh, it is?
In that quarter.
Right.
Ah.
So if you look at the bottom, non-current assets, loans receivable net of current portion, then less allowance for loan loss, total non-current assets.
I guess a better question might be, these aren't dollars going out the door.
No.
So in our non-current assets on 47, we've got the refinance loans receivable, and then we're subtracting from that 22606 to get the total non-current assets. This is like just accounting. This is GAAP stuff. Right.
Yes.
We're not actually spending the dollars. They're not going out the door.
No.
It's like depreciation or.
Correct.
Yeah. Thank you.
But it's over a 10% loan loss reserve.
Correct.
Oh, are you going to continue at that level?
Marty, we have a spreadsheet that we use to calculate it based on the FICO ranges and where those loans FICO scores fell into the matrix.
But it's interesting. We're going to make $7 million worth of loans approximately, and you're going to have a $700,000 loan loss reserve against us, $7 million. I mean, that's a lot of loan loss.
So, Marty, what we're saying is that the loan loss is determined based on FICO score and in conjunction with loan term, the matrix that we have. So it's not a straight percentage. It's not a flat percentage that we're going to assess against, you know, the entire outstanding amount of loans.
Is that you're going to do it loan by loan.
Correct.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay, Carly, anything else?
Nope, I did not have anything else unless there's other questions.
Questions for Carly? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're down to some reports. Jeanette, authority update?
Yes, so I wanted to comment on the loan yield liability. If you recall, a couple meetings ago, we talked about there being a loan yield liability associated with the 2013 bonds, totaling around $300,000. And we've been working with BLX as our rebate consultants. And we also, if you recall, we had talked about convening kind of a working group consisting of me, Josh, bond counsel, and financial advisor, as well as the rebate consultant, and to develop an approach for how are we going to mitigate this loan yield liability by next May 15th, which is the final date by which it will have to be resolved. And so the rebate consultant this month is doing some refreshed calculations and to make sure that we're calculating the loan yield liability as accurately as possible. And from there, what we will do is at the January board meeting, we will bring to the board our specific mitigation plan, which is to provide a reduction in principal balance on those outstanding loans, sort of, you know, applying a percentage across all loans to get to that, the estimated liability, which right now is around $300,000. So we'll bring that to the board for approval in January. And in the meantime, you know, also be working, you know, Josh will be working as needed with the loan servicer in terms of communications to borrowers, et cetera. So are there any, as I said, that'll be coming back to the board in January. So I don't know if there are any questions at this point.
Any questions? Okay.
And then I wanted to touch on the economic impact study. If you recall, we heard from the consultant who did that study at the last board meeting. And since then, we have distributed the study to all legislators, to the governor's office, DECD, Advance CT, which is another economic development arm. And then also Dan Genji, our communications and legislative liaison, has also reached out to, you know, various media outlets to see if we can get any, you know, targeted press regarding the economic impact study. And then from there, we will more generally circulate additional press releases. We've also submitted it to the Metro Hartford Alliance, and as well as the Education Finance Council, which is CHEFWA's trade association, so that they can highlight it in some of their publications as well. So we're actively working on disseminating and publicizing and promoting the study and its conclusions.
Okay.
So that's all I have for the authority updates.
Thank you, Jeanette. Any questions? Okay, Josh, portfolio update.
Thanks, Peter. So if I can start on page 54 of the board package, we have our in-school loan disbursement data. For the first quarter, the CHESL in-school program dispersed $7.9 million. This represents an increase of $1.3 million compared to quarter one of fiscal 22. So we're happy with that loan volume thus far. Moving on to page 57 of the board package, we have the comparison to the cash flow assumptions for the 2022 B series. Through October, CHESL is currently $1.2 million ahead of the cash flow assumptions. So again, very good on the loan volume front thus far. Moving on to page 58. We have the refi program loan disbursement data. For the first quarter, REFI CT dispersed $803,000, representing a $700,000 increase compared to quarter one of fiscal 22. This quarter was also REFI CT's second highest quarter one ever, dating back to the first ever quarter when the program started. So also very happy with the REFI loan volume so far. Moving on to page 63 of the board package, I just wanted to touch on some metrics with our loan originator campus door for both in-school and the refinance program. Campus door did not meet the standards for the quarter. I reached out to campus door for an explanation, and they stated that due to the peak season, their contact center experienced higher than normal call volumes, which contributed to the longer wait times. Campus door is already debriefed as a group after the peak season, and they're working through plans to make sure there is adequate staffing in place and system enhancements are made to make everything more efficient moving forward. And Chesil will certainly continue to keep an eye on this for future quarters. I think that's all I have for the portfolio update. Are there any questions?
Questions for Josh?
Josh, I'm just curious, what do you think are attributed to the increase in the refi for this quarter?
I think part of the reason with the refinance program, if you recall, the proceeds that we are utilizing are some of that $5 million from our 22 series refunding. So our proceeds are not tied to bond funds. We are basically originating those loans off of our balance sheet. And I think where our refinance rates are currently, which is 3.75% fixed to 4.99% fixed, I think those rates are basically below market conditions and very attractive rates to refinancing applicants.
Thanks.
How did we pick those rates?
If I recall, Marty, we changed these rates back in December of 2021. And basically, when we were no longer originating refinance loans with bond funds, I believe we reduced the rates by 1% across the matrix. And at the time, we had made those changes after looking at some refinancing competitors in the industry. But as you know, since December of 2021, the market has changed a bit and rates have gone up. So those rates are now even more attractive.
Yeah. I mean, it's really a bargain and should really accelerate the refi program,
I think.
Correct. And I believe the loan volume so far in the second quarter for refi is doing well so far as well.
Okay. Anything else for Josh? Well done, Josh. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Shannon, marketing update?
Yep. Thank you. Good morning, everybody, or is it afternoon? It is. So first on slide 73, we're going to go over CT dollars and cents. Again, this is a comparison for Q1 of fiscal year 22 to this fiscal year. Always continued goal is to bring awareness to CT dollars and cents and the resources we provide. More people are continuing to know about CT dollars and cents because they are now increase of direct website, meaning they're either Googling or typing in CT dollars and cents themselves. We went from 236 visits to over 650 visits this year direct to site. Returning visitors to the site went up from 7% to 36%. Number of sessions increased as well, which just means the group of interactions or engagements that the person is doing on the site increased by 5%. And then visitors are spending more time on the site, the bounce rate decreased by 52%. So overall, very positive feedback on CT Dollars and Cents, and awareness is building on that. Next slide for 74. For the CHEZ overview, again, this is a comparison of the last fiscal year for Q1. We saw an increase in users from the year prior. CHEZ went from 7,800 users to over 22,000 coming in that time frame. Top pages visited was the for Q1 was the homepage, in school loan, which matches with our peak time, combined over 33,000 page views compared to the year prior, which is 13,000, and the number of sessions increased by 28%. So overall, we're getting more engagement, more visitors to the site. Next. So overall, we kind of are out of COVID in regards to in-person events, which I personally am really excited about. So we published two articles in the CT Insider spotlighting CHEZ's various programs. We attended the Money Conference for Women, which was in person for the first time in 2 years. Josh was a guest on a podcast episode for Spring Path, discussing all of CHEZ's programs and college planning process. We hosted financial aid nights at South Windsor High School, Rocky Hill High School, and our that totaled about over 100 parents. And we currently have 3 more financial sessions booked. And then we had a very busy college fair session across the state. We included 10 town fairs, the Southern TT College Fair, Spring Path College Fair, where we dispersed over 500 CHEZLA folders that has a bunch of resources. That is all, unless anybody has any questions.
Shannon, this is Peter, yes. Whether you or Josh, but what is Spring Path?
So it's a newer organization, Peter, that's trying to, connect students directly with colleges and make that more of a seamless process.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Questions for Shannon on the marketing side? All right. Thank you, Shannon.
Thank you.
And Yesenia on the scholarship program.
Hi, everybody. I just have a quick update. If you remember, the board approved $30,000 for the certificate scholarship. That is about 24 total scholarships. So far, we have dispersed 10, leaving 14 scholarships available until the new fiscal year in July. As of now, we are sending monthly emails to all the Connecticut colleges that offer certificate programs, and that has seemed to help bring up the applications that we have received. And that's pretty much it. Does anyone have any questions?
Any questions for Yesenia?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Peter, I wanted to go back to our refi program, if I can. We only have $2 million. We put out 800,000 in the first quarter. It looks like we're going to use up that $2 million in less than a year because of our fabulous rates, right, especially once word of mouth gets around. Where are we going to get additional refi money for continuing the program?
So if I could just clarify a bit there. So we have $3 million because we received $5 million from the 22 series refunding, and we're authorized to utilize up to $2 million for in-school. So we have at least $3 million for the refi program, which, looking at historical data, we've only cleared the $3 million threshold for refi once, which was fiscal year 2019. Jeanette, I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that. I mean, there's also the possibility we don't use all of that $2 million for in-school either, which would then I mean, it's allocated for refi as well.
Right. And then even if it is used for in-school in the spring, we would be under the inducement resolution bonding to reimburse ourselves for any of the dollars used for in-school. So there's this $5 million pot of money available. $2 million right now is going to in-school, but come next spring, that should be back to $5 million available for refi. And then the other thing we will be doing is, reassessing the loan rates on the refi program. You know, obviously we want to be very low cost and provide that sort of benefit. You know, however, you know, as market conditions shift, we're also trying to assess where we are relative to the market overall. So we will also be, you know, taking a fresh review of refi loan rates as well.
Well, of course, if we have to go back to bonding refi, the rates will jump significantly.
Right.
So just keep right. that I in mean, mind.
Yeah, we would prefer, yeah, bonding, you know, at this point would be on a taxable basis. So yes, we're trying to avoid going back to bonding. Also to the extent that we're making loans from dollars that are not part of a bond transaction on the refi side, then we have the ability to, you know, recycle and take loan payments and use them to make new loans, that kind of thing.
So. Could you, Jeanette, sometime in our April meeting or March meeting, could you give us a plan, a business plan for refi with respect to rates? You know, by then you'll see what kind of market there is. But I would love to hear management's proposal as how to continue refi as best we can and what calculations go into that plan.
Sure, we can plan that for the March meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marty. Anyone else? Any other questions? Okay, last couple of items on the agenda. In your meeting packet is the meeting schedule for 2023. Please put those dates on your calendar. And is there any other business anyone would like to bring forward? Anything for the good of the cause right now? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
Peter, I'm sorry, it's Denise. Could you just move for a vote to approve the meeting schedule?
Oh, that record. Okay.
No. I move we adopt the meeting schedule.
Thank you, Marty. I'm going to second it. Are there any discussion items on that? Any discussion or questions? Thank you, Denise, for that clarification. All those in favor of adopting the meeting schedule as presented in your meeting packet, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. The meeting schedule passes. Please make those notations in your calendar. Is there any other business anyone would like to bring forward? Hearing none, I would entertain a motion to adjourn. Is there a motion?
No move.
Anyone? Marty moved it. Is there a second? I'll be happy to second it. All those in favor of adjournment, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Any abstentions? The motion carries. We're adjourned.